George Washington. It's one of the most recognizable names in the world. His story is a foundational stone in American history. Yet at the place he was born, only remnants remain of the buildings and the stories of people who once lived here. One might think that the birthplace of a national icon is an easy story to tell, but it's actually one of the most complex and surprising historic sites preserved by the National Park Service. So join us as we piece together the past, present, and future of this place, brick by brick, on this podcast series, Upon This Land, History, Mystery, and Monuments. In January of 1930, George Washington Birthplace National Monument was created as a unit of the National Park Service. At the same time the park was created, the Wakefield National Memorial Association was working to preserve the landscape of George's childhood. Among the association's plans was to build a Memorial House Museum worthy of the first president. During the construction of the Memorial House Museum, archaeologists excavated a colonial-era brick foundation yards away. The MPS waited until the completion of the Memorial House Museum before further investigating the foundation. When the large brick foundation was finally fully exposed in 1936, it led some to speculate that this was the original location of George Washington's birth home, especially when coupled with the numerous 18th-century artifacts recovered during the excavation. The foundation was named Building X due to the uncertainty of what it truly represented. In the 1970s, another archaeological project was completed but yielded no new evidence to prove that Building X was the birth home of George Washington. The NPS, however, began to refer to this location as the definitive ruins of the birth home. During this period, the nation was celebrating its bicentennial in 1976. And the resulting pressure to identify the location of George's birth home may have been the driving force behind this dramatic change. In the early 21st century, advancements in historic archaeology led park staff and archaeologists to review the efficacy of past excavations and analysis, which, in turn, led to a recommendation to reopen the foundations for re-examination. In partnership with New South Associates, Inc., Building X was once again opened in 2022 with the hopes of shedding more light on 86 years of uncertainty. On this episode of our podcast, we share findings from this recent study of Building X, bring us one step closer to unraveling one of the biggest mysteries of the park. Hi, my name's Dustin Baker, and I'm the Chief of Interpretation and Education here at George Washington Birthplace National Monument. Joining me today is Carrie Gonzalez, Chief of Cultural Resource Management for the park, Jonathan Malriott, Lead Interpretive Park Ranger, and Maureen Myers, Principal Investigator of Archaeology with New South Associates. All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We actually have two new guests on the podcast this month. And if y'all could introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Carrie Gonzalez. I'm the Chief of Cultural Resource Management at George Washington Birthplace and Thomas Stone National Historic Site.
Hi, I'm Maureen Myers. I'm a Principal Investigator of Archaeology at New South Associates, based in Stone Mountain, Georgia.
Okay, so Carrie, why don't you take a second and tell us, what does your job entail as the Cultural Resource Specialist? What is that job, or even what's your background in getting into that job?
Well, the background's easier to explain because I feel like I do so many things here. I wear so many hats. My background is in historic archaeology. I've been doing archaeology professionally since 2001. That's when I got my first job as a field technician in Pennsylvania. And I've been working in, I worked in the cultural resource management industry for 20 years. I just recently came to the birthplace And just for the listeners, I'll probably refer to the park here as the birthplace or Jiwa throughout the rest of this. I came here in January. I was a lab manager for a long time with the firm, so I've got a strong background in material culture, artifacts from all different time periods. Here, I'm responsible for all the archaeological resources and architectural resources, so both above and below ground, helping with compliance if something needs to be done to one of the buildings or there's ground disturbance. I help with research, plan excavations, and just, you know, help preserve and protect and interpret the wonderful resources that we have here.
Yeah, that definitely is an all-encompassing title there.
It is.
So, Maureen, you said, I think it was primary investigator. So do you want to tell us a bit what that entails and also what your background is?
Sure. Actually, principal investigator. And so that entails, I oversee about at least a dozen, 12 to 15 projects at a time for New South. I don't go in the field very much anymore. I do occasionally. So I do a range of projects. We have contracts with most, I think, all DOTs in the Southeast, most of the DOTs. And then we also have contracts with different Park Service units, Forest Service, Corps of Engineers. So, for example, right now I have a crew in the field in Mississippi on a 1,000-acre survey for pine beetle infestation that has to be done. And I'm also overseeing the report writing of other similar things. We have a lot of Corps of Engineers right now. But I also do things like I did a revised National Historic Landmark for a mound site in Arkansas, and I write a lot of cultural context and do research on another site on the Natchez Trace in Mississippi, and then I do oversee a lot of Georgia projects and Virginia projects. So I'm actually a native of Virginia. I grew up in the Fairfax area. I knew from an early age I wanted to do archaeology, and my first archaeology was as a volunteer in high school at Mount Vernon, because it was real close to my house and they had Saturday hours and they were wonderful with volunteers. I went on to Radford and then UGA and ultimately University of Kentucky for my degrees. And I actually did, I do a lot of my research on a mound site in Southwest Virginia, and I still do research there and work with folks there. I have done a lot of cultural resource management and for many years did it in Virginia, out of Richmond for different offices. But I've also worked in South Carolina, and my specialties are Native Americans of the late contact period, pre-contact and contact period. And I actually study Native American women and households and production of fabrics and dyes and those kind of things. So I have wide-ranging interests. So
you mentioned an acronym of CRM. Do you want to take a second to explain what CRM is? Just so anyone who's not familiar with that term, aka myself, has an idea.
Sure. CRM stands for Cultural Resource Management. There's about a 150-year history of archaeology in the U.S. But it wasn't until the 1960s, as we experienced a lot of building boom and infrastructure boom after World War II. So the building, the construction of all the major highways, archaeologists began to realize that a lot of cultural resources, what most people would term archaeology sites and important architecture, historic architecture, was being destroyed. And so the National Historic Preservation Act, passed in the late 1960s, was a way that a lot of archaeologists came together to make sure that those resources, if they were important, were not going to be destroyed and would otherwise be recorded. And so that created the National Register of Historic Places, which has different criteria for listing sites on it. And then also it created state historic preservation offices for every state. and it created a state archaeological registry. And it mandated what's known as Section 106. It's Section 106 of the NHPA, the National Historic Preservation Act. So it mandated that any project that uses federal monies and often state monies has to do a survey to identify archaeological sites and determine if they are significant for listing on that national register. As a result of that law passage, a lot of CRM was sort of born, cultural resource management. In the 1970s and 80s and into today, we now have a multi-million dollar industry, really, of private firms like mine that meet that demand. And so we answer any kind of work proposals that are put out by any federal and usually state agency to meet their mandates. And so that's a general sense. I think Carrie can talk more specifically to how the NPS works in that, if y'all want.
If I could add for the listeners too, that I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, Maureen, but at least 80% of the archaeological sites identified in the United States are through CRM.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great point. So I should follow up with 4 out of 5 archaeologists in the United States are employed this way. It is, as Carrie says, how most of archaeology gets done in the United States. It's really important archaeology, and we have a massive database, every state does, of all the archaeological sites that's added to all the time. It's really quite a, I think it's a tremendous thing and a great use of tax dollars. So, yeah.
We are very lucky to have both of you on the podcast. And what really is bringing us all together for this episode is a really important archaeological feature here at George Washington Birthplace National Monument, known as Building X. And this feature was reopened in spring of 2022, and it's been refilled almost exactly 2 years ago. But this site had actually been opened as far back as the 1930s and studied. So after almost 100 years, what motivated the park and experts to take another look at this site?
The other thing I will put in there on that is Maureen is was the lead on this excavation that was doing this. So that's why we have her and Carrie, who's our cultural resource specialist, on this call answering these questions for us.
So, why did we look at a feature that had been excavated in the 30s and then looked at again in 1970s by Dr. Norman Barka? And there's several reasons. Technologies change, and I'll let Maureen get into that a little bit more since her firm was the one that did that. But we wanted to take a whole encompassing look at Building X. It was completely exposed. And most importantly, we wanted Willie Graham, a foremost expert on early buildings in the Chesapeake, to really get in there and get up close with the brick and the mortar and the joinings and all of those construction methods to let that speak to him, to tell, so he could develop a construction phase narrative for us. And that was really important for us to understand how Building X was constructed. And we were able, from what New South did and through Willie Graham's analysis, to determine that there were at least 3 construction phases. It started out as a 1-room building, and then it evolved and grew over time. It grew out. You know, it's a nice landscape, and when you have a lot of land, it's easier to build out than up, and that was how Building X evolved.
Right, and so the purpose of our work was to really expose and analyze and record Building X. And so let me say, too, that, the site was excavated in the 1930s. It's actually, to me, a really interesting example and really one of the first earliest excavations in in the U.S. and certainly in Virginia, it's really part of the birth of historic archaeology as a discipline. As an archaeologist, I kind of geek out on that a little bit. I think that's really cool because I really like looking at the history of archaeology. But one of the things I think we need to keep in mind is that when an archaeologist, and I used to teach archaeology a lot. And so one of the things we always say to archaeologists is you kind of get one shot, right? You can't usually re-excavate a site. Once you remove the fill and the artifacts, they're taken out of the context in which we find them. And so by doing that, a lot of people think archaeology is all about the artifacts and the things that you find. But for archaeologists, it is equally, if not more important, to understand the context in which the artifacts are found. So we can identify, if all the kitchenware is together, that tells us, hey, this might be the kitchen. Or if there's non-kitchenware things, or we could separate where people are cooking versus eating versus doing their other things, just as our own homes are separated in that way. So when you remove that context, it gets more difficult to do that. And so normally, most sites, you can only dig them once. And so archaeologists are very good about keeping very good records. When you go back to a site that's already been excavated, there should be a pretty good reason to do that. Because you're not going to get a whole lot of information because the context is gone. So some of the things we were looking for was to see, well, did the 1930s archaeologists, remove all the context? I mean, did they remove all the original filling there, the soils, or is there anything left to see? And just like we have advanced our, all disciplines advance, our discipline is more advanced in methods. We had some interesting methods that we could apply just by removing the fill that was there and seeing the remains and having somebody like Willie Graham come and look at the actual remains of the structure and then just see what else there might be. So there were a couple of good reasons in this case, I think, to go back to the site and look at what was there.
So not only was there this previous excavation, but there's also a lot of oral traditions about this site. So did any of y'all come in with expectations of what you would find or have any preconceived notions? And were those challenged?
That's a good question. I think if I had a preconceived notion, I think the thing that surprised me was that that the archaeology they did in the 30s was as good as they did. That was really, kind of surprising to me. I was aware of some of the different stories, and I take those into account. But just like, as I said, I first learned my archaeology at Mount Vernon. There's lots of stories about George Washington that, as we all know, may or may not be true, right? And so the thing I like about the archaeology is that it reflects the behavior of what people actually did. So we all know that people can tell you something or that ideas and stories are passed down, or maybe in our own families they're passed down. But then, the way to test those is you can't go back and ask the ancestors, but you can look at the archaeology and see what it says because it's showing behavior. And so I don't know that I think I've done this so long now that I listen, I think oral histories are very important, especially when we're talking about our indigenous ancestors. And I use those as just another line of evidence. But I do rely, I'm trained as an archaeologist, so I rely on the archaeology to see what it's going to say. So I'm not sure that I necessarily went in there other than I thought, well, I'm sure, whatever we find that they did in the 30s isn't going to be that great. And I was actually really surprised as we dived, we sort of dove into the records and saw some photographs and some records that it was actually very good.
When I started at the park, I was surprised too at how well the archaeology was done. It's not necessarily, if we had Building X to go excavate today, never had been excavated before, would we do it differently? Yes. But knowing how other things were excavated early on and using that as a comparison where someone was just wildly digging, they did do a good job.
So what are some of the differences between how the excavation was done in the 1930s and how the excavation is done today? Like, you're saying that there is differences, like if you did were doing it today, it would be different. So what are some of those? What has changed?
Okay. So probably the main thing they did right was they paid attention to the soil stratigraphy. And they also used what's known as arbitrary layers to excavate. So they excavated in each layer was, I don't remember specifically, but we use arbitrary layers today, normally 10 centimeters. And from there, you can actually reconstruct the stratigraphy later. So they both recorded the stratigraphy and were able to reconstruct it. And that was really nice. The thing that wasn't great was they used a grid system, which is what we do. So, and that allows you to record where the artifacts actually are or where the different, what we call features in the soil are. And then you can reconstruct this because that's all you're doing with archaeology. You're, meticulously recording everything you find so that later on when you can't look at it anymore because you've excavated it, you're going to be able to reconstruct it. And they did do that. However, their grid system was, to put it nicely, it was really convoluted. I'm not even sure I fully understand. I think Phil Levy actually may be the only person that fully understands it. One of the things it did was use the same letters or numbers again. And so it's very difficult to tell where, if an artifact is actually from this part of the grid system or that part of the grid system. And if you grid systems are pretty new when they were excavating in the 1930s. So if you're new at using a grid system, it's a common sort of newbie error. And I think we all learn from that. Like somebody learned from that then and we don't do that now. But it does confuse some of the artifactual evidence that they got. And it made it hard to reconstruct what was found where. So those are the two of the main things, but then also having someone like Willie Graham, right? The whole field of architectural history developed since probably was starting to develop. And so it's much more developed. We've got many more excavations of historic 17th and 18th century architecture, especially in colonial Virginia, because colonial Williamsburg was created, right? Because J.C. Herington did a lot of the excavations there. And so you've got someone like Willie Graham who is using all of that information to then go back to this site and interpret it. So that's pretty big. And then we did a few other things. We were able to do a 3D laser scan of the remains. They certainly couldn't have done that in the 1930s. And then we also used something called portable X-ray fluorescence to try to identify the mortar and the brick, what recipes were used to make both the mortar and the brick. We had more limited success with that, but again, it was something that they wouldn't have used in the 1930s.
And with the PXRF, they also were able to determine the wash on the brick. Isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they found higher levels of some elements in both the mortar and the brick, which could indicate a few different things. So I did sort of pull on my Mount Vernon knowledge a little bit and my, being an archaeologist in Virginia, you tend to learn a lot about the 17th and 18th century. And I realized at some point that, oh, right, they would do a lime wash on this brick or possibly painted the brick. And those would explain the higher amounts of those particular elements that were found in the PXRF. And one thing, and Carrie and I were talking about this a bit on one of our conversations, that PXRF sort of opens the door for us to start to wonder or really be able to investigate, are they making the bricks and the mortar right there on site? Or is it being made elsewhere and shipped in, which I wouldn't expect, other than that would be an expense. And maybe that's a way to brag to your neighbors or to show your increasing wealth that you actually had bricks made at an actual, you know, known brick factory and shipped in. But it would be very expensive to do that. So I would expect it's being made locally, and we'd need a little bit more work in order to follow that line of questioning, you know, a bit more.
A very nice segue, because it is a research avenue that we are exploring here at the park to see if we can narrow that down a little more, because it would be interesting to know.
Yeah. It also allows you to compare those bricks, or in general, the entire site, to other similar sites in the region. There are a couple of good examples in the region, and you could examine those and just see, okay, well, how does the Washington family compare to other similar planters of that class? And how does that change over time? And how far, are there sites, say, in Louisa County that are similar, or sites closer to Williamsburg? I mean, I think it starts to show you a bigger picture of the founding of Virginia and how wealth increased and changed over time, and how different families controlled that wealth.
So another question I have about the excavation is, so your team was the one tasked with doing the excavation. So mm-hmm. when you're coming into the site, how does that start? Like, are you coming in with a backhoe and just immediately digging right in, or
right?
How does that whole process happen?
I should say that another PI at our firm, Kevin Bradley, oversaw the excavations. He sadly couldn't be here. He's real sad not to miss it. But I will say also that this was a fun one, because not only is it called Building X, but in a sense, X marked the spot. So because this had been identified and excavated in the 1930s and then filled in, the park had outlined the building itself in white gravel. And I believe, Carrie, y'all did that again, right, after we were finished?
Yeah, and so now it represents the archaeological remains, what y'all exposed. Okay. And it's, anyone who hasn't been out to come see it, you really should. It's yeah. pretty beautiful.
Yeah. Right. So because of that, that made it easier to know, okay, well, here's where we dig. And so we started by, you know, removing those, the original outline of the building that was visible at the ground surface. And then you remove the grass, and you usually, you know, sometimes some places like Mount Vernon, we would preserve the grass. And so there's a special way to remove it, keep it alive so it can be put back on, as sod pieces. And then at that point, what we did was use shovels to take off the topsoil. And we did it very carefully in layers. The soil is always laid down in layers. And so as archaeologists, when you remove it slowly in layers. And we did that till we found the top of the brick remains. And then also did use a grader with a really smooth bucket, a small grader, and a trained operator who came in and carefully, removed a lot of the fill. And then he did that in some places. He was able to do that. In other places, we did it by shovel into wheelbarrows, and then the backhoe person could move that farther off site. You don't want your backfill too close to where you're excavating, because it can become a really dangerous situation with unstable walls and things. So you've got to keep in mind safety issues. Keep in mind, the remains, and that you need to carefully remove the fill. And then at that point, you move from shovels to trowels and really identify and expose all of the brick remains. And so they're fully exposed. And this is where, most people think of archaeologists as using brushes. You might get out a brush at this point to kind of clean the bricks and that kind of thing. And just fully expose that. And we took a lot of photographs. And we took notes at every stage of what we were doing.
If I could jump in for a minute, because yeah. some of the listeners might be like, they used a backhoe? That's, Why would they use that? But backhoes are used a lot in archaeology, especially in CRM. For in this case, the backhoe was used because Building X was filled with fill that was not, it didn't have any significant artifacts in it, but we use them on other sites too. It's actually called the Virginia Marshalltown here in Virginia. Marshalltown is a brand of trowel that most archaeologists use. It's so backhoes are, you know, it's just another tool in our toolbox to expedite excavation to get down to the your intact features, the stuff where you're going to get that solid data that's going to help you date and understand a site.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when you know that the fill is just fill, that it's already been disturbed, and that we knew that in this case, right? It had been taken out in the 30s, and then when they refilled it, they just kind of threw it back in there. There's no context for the artifacts at all. In fact, there weren't very many artifacts in some of the, you know, in the upper layers of that fill. Yeah, it is very common in general. And when I excavated a site in Southwest Virginia, I knew like the top foot was all fill. It was all plow zone fill. And I used a backhoe to take that off. It's a quick way to do it. It's always monitored. I mean, every scoop by the backhoe operator is monitored by a trained archaeologist wearing a hard hat, let me emphasize. And then once you find any kind of intact cultural features, the backhoe stops and you switch to the archaeologist using hand tools, shovels and trowels.
So during the excavation, were there any thing you extracted or uncovered or any part of the excavation that you were really excited about, whether it be an artifact itself or even something else during the excavation that was interesting or surprising?
I mean, first, it was just cool to uncover the whole outline and to see it. I mean, for me, that's always just a pretty cool moment, right? I mean, and you get more remains than you normally do at a lot of other sites. One artifact that stuck out to me was a piece of brick that had, I think it had a signature on it or some kind of lettering on it. And we never were able to figure out what that was. But it was a nice intact piece. And again, if we could do more brick studies, we might be able to figure out, you know, more information about who's making the brick. So that wasn't uncommon. Some of the brick pieces they can just have these markings from where you're taking the hot brick, right? Or you're taking the not fully formed brick and it gets a mark of a fingerprint or something like that on there. And then other times we find brick that does have people's, you know, markings or signatures or something on it. So that was kind of interesting to see. And again, I get really interested in, okay, who are the people that make the wealth possible or who are the other people around? And so to find indicators of those people, who's working at this family farm whose names aren't recorded in history and how might they try to be remembered in some way? And so that could be an interesting clue to that.
But we can't forget about all the cats and the dogs that walk across the wet brick. I mean, we always find those. And I will say that I had the brick that you mentioned, Maureen, with the letters on it. We had that 3D scanned, and through doing that, and maybe you knew this, but it's an ILL, and that's what we have left on it. And I like to joke with one of our interps here. His name is Bill. I was like, oh, Bill, that's what they were writing.
Right, that's right.
So you mentioned Kevin Bradley earlier. I just want to give him a shout out. He was, if you're listening, Kevin, you were great to work with, and you really helped us and the visitors understand what was going on each day. So we really appreciate that.
Can I give an additional shout out to Kevin? And I apologize, I can't remember the other staff member with New South's name, but they came out with their total station a couple months ago when it was probably at its hottest and spent an entire day out here mapping the outline of Building X so we could put the outline back in. And I think they were here till almost 6 o'clock getting that done for us. And that was, it was a huge effort and really appreciated.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Upon This Land, History, Mystery, and Monuments. Our conversations with Maureen and Carrie are not over. They'll be joining us on our next episode as we explore the results of the excavation and what that tells us about Building X. And they'll also talk about how we're preserving it into the future. Join us on our next episode.